This is Zephyr Thrall. You're listening to Frank Prattle. The station is Art International Radio, or artonair.org. We're here live in Portland with two of my favorite people in the entire galaxy. We have Ruth Ann Brown, who runs the New American Art Union here in Portland, Oregon, as well as Brian Sereth, who's the director of Disjecta. Hi, guys.
Hello, Zephyr. Thank you for having us and visiting with us here in Portland.
Hello, Zephyr. How are you today?
I'm just dandy. Maybe you guys can tell us a little bit about yourself and what it is that you do. Ruth?
My name is Ruth Ann, and I am the founder and director of the New American Art Union, commonly referred to as NAAU, in Portland, Oregon. And for the first 3 years of our existence, we opened in October of 2004. We functioned primarily as a commercial gallery space representing emerging and mid-career artists in all media. And for the last year and going through 2009, our programming is stipend-based, whereby each artist who exhibits gets an $8,000 stipend for producing a six-week body of work.
Sounds good, and we'll definitely get back to that later. Brian, yourself?
Hello, Radio Public. This is Brian Sereth. I run the Disjecta Interdisciplinary Arts Center here in Portland, Oregon. It's been around as a nonprofit contemporary art organization since 2004. Prior to that, from the year 2000 through 2004, it was a privately run contemporary gallery and exhibition space. Our focus is to provide artists, both regionally and nationally, with the opportunity to exhibit new work, both create and exhibit new work, at our 12,000 square foot facility in North Portland.
A giant beauty.
Indeed.
Big mama.
So one of the things, I mean, let's cut straight to the heart of the matter. The United States is currently in a world of shit as far as the economic world, and that directly translates over to the art world. Galleries are closing left and right in New York and across the country. Galleries are closing here in Portland as well. And both of you are fairly fresh voices in Portland. Brian, you've been around a little bit longer with Disjecta, but both of you guys are, you know, fairly fresh to the scene. How is it going economically for you guys?
Well, luckily for me, at least, I sort of budgeted to lose money for 2 years with the stipend program.
That was brilliant. Stroke of genius.
So I am relatively unaffected. Also, I benefit from the fact that the gallery is housed in a concrete block building in Lower East Side of Portland that I purchased about 6 years ago. So despite the real estate in Portland declining a bit, the real estate appreciation since I purchased the building has been relatively significant. So thankfully, I'm pretty insulated from the problem. However, we are noticing right now a lot of galleries are not. Quality Pictures most recently closed.
Quality Pictures closed?
Yeah, they closed last week.
I did not know that. That's quite astounding. Quality Pictures was, what, within the last 2 years, a relatively new gallery.
They just turned two, I believe.
Right. Pretty high stakes gallery. I mean, they really went for it. Seemed to have. Did you know the owner?
Yeah, Eric.
Yeah, yeah. I never met him, but savvy guy.
He did,
yeah.
I think he did a very good job.
Yeah.
He experienced, which I think will be the problem going forward for not just Portland galleries, but other galleries, where the bust was preceded by a boom, i.e. people overextended themselves greatly, assuming that the good times would keep on rolling. So galleries, which were in the past probably a lot more agile, which were in less expensive spaces and with less expensive programming, upped the ante and since needs to make quite a lot of money to continue funding themselves.
That's an artificial bubble that's sort of been in place in other, obviously, economic areas, but from our perspective in Portland, we're a nonprofit organization, so it's also slightly different, although we do rely very heavily on individual corporate contributions. Those have slipped. People are definitely cinching the purses in anticipation that their own funds will not, you know, they won't be as liquid in the next few years as they batten down the hatches. The flow to nonprofit organizations, especially in the arts, declines. And in some respects, while not quite as brilliant as Ruth Ann, in our business planning, we did try to also insulate ourselves. Portland has been a very difficult town to actually open and subsist as a contemporary art space. We've seen several come and go over the years. We've watched that, and we tried to build a model that would be able to sustain itself when there are dips in the economy or when giving goes down. And one of the things that we've done, I mentioned the 12,000 square foot building, 4,000 square feet of that is dedicated to artist studio space. It's below market lease rates for the artists, so that it's affordable, and yet it provides us with a steady stream of income that we hope won't be cut off during an economic recession because the studio spaces are so cheap. So that is one way we've insulated ourselves. The second is that our overhead and programming are very low. We went to, here in Portland, what we call the farthest reaches of town. We went to North Portland. It's a beautiful neighborhood. It's wonderful. It's not very far away in comparison to other cities, other metropolitan areas. But the real estate was cheaper up there. We lease our building. We got a very favorable lease rate, and we're hoping that that'll sustain us through these tough times.
As well as do I, as well as does Portland, I'm sure. One of the things that people have been hearing about internationally is your new mayor, the mayor of Portland, whose name is Sam Adams. Sam Adams had run on a platform of being a mayor for the arts, if I'm not mistaken, one that was really going to help Portland become kind of a national star as far as the arts and really give back to the city. And unfortunately, got embroiled in a bit of a scandal here right after the starting blocks, and got mixed up with a 17 or 18 year old child or man, depending on what you qualify it as.
Man child. Typical verbiage for that description.
Bo Breedlove, man child. And what has been some of the fallout of this? I mean, are you both a little nervous that this arts funding won't come through?
Well, that's a great question, and I know that in the arts community there has been a big rally around Sam Adams. A lot of people in the arts community felt like this was their chance to turn the corner for arts funding from the government, the regional government. I think that in the state of Oregon, overall, we rank something like 47th or 48th. Nationally, in terms of the government funding arts, and so that is something that Sam has seized on and said we need to do better, and I think that people in the arts community in Portland felt like this is a great rallying point if Sam Adams can get elected into office, and so he is definitely running that platform. But that said, in an economic situation that surrounds us right now, that may not be a reality one way or the other without the scandal that he's currently gotten himself involved in. But from our perspective, we're happy to hear anyone talk about funding the arts. But I'm always reserved. My expectations are low, and I think that if we can operate with low expectations, Then if something does come through, it's we celebrate. We really didn't expect it, but if there is more money and the arts can grow in this community, that's a wonderful thing.
What about yourself, Ruth Ann? Is a for profit but kind of acting as a not profit for the past couple of years? What does Sam Adams mean to you?
You know, not to be too negative here, but Sam has never meant a whole lot to me. Only because I believe him wholeheartedly when he says he wants to support the arts. I read over quite a bit of his creative capacity initiative, which seemed very unspecific and gave absolutely no direction as to how it would be completed or approached or where specifically the funding would come from. So I didn't frankly expect a whole lot from Sam. And, you know, I would second absolutely what Brian just said, and that whatever possibilities were within him have been completely null and void because of the current economy. However, I should say that Portland is doing a few things correctly. Their percent for the arts, where a certain percentage of most construction budgets go towards public art, is a good thing. There is Oregon Cultural Trust, which is abysmally underfunded.
But they are growing.
They are growing.
I don't know if you call it an endowment. They're growing the revenues that they pull in from Oregonians every year. I think for the last 3 years, it's gone up by $1 million or $2 million.
Absolutely.
Their total budget. So they're working on it, but Oregon still, you know, with the government not funding anything in most capacities, these entities are going to be important to turn the corner. I know for both of us, you know, I don't know how to define small or medium sized or mid sized entities. I mean, we're Distracta especially is about 4 years old, and we have a great deal of ambition, but our budget isn't one that's sky high, and that doesn't place us among the elite cultural organizations in Portland. So we really don't expect to see much of any activity anyway. It's usually about funding and sustaining the big entities, the symphony, the opera, the Portland Art Museum. You know, these entities tend to get, when those funds do increase, tend to get a bulk of them, for better or worse. And so those of us below that meridian are always scrambling and doing our best to get by. So Sam Adams, one way or another, whoever's the mayor, I just don't think that we put a lot of stock in them being any sort of savior the community.
To speak to that, as far as, you know, scraping by, it's a thankless job, being a gallery or a director of a nonprofit or something like that. Being the boss in the arts is not fun on any level. Whether you're running the Whitney or you're running just some gallery down the street, it's hard, right? And oftentimes, one of the things that that I want to know is why do you stay in the game? I mean, is it love? Is it you know, mystery profit? Is it spite? Why do you continue to run your space?
Well, I mean, that sort of is a larger existential question. I think that if I really thought about it, I'd probably stop doing it.
autopilot in the back of your mind.
Yeah, I don't really see myself doing anything else, honestly. And specifically to address Portland, you know, I think that there is oftentimes too much of a weird provincial attitude in Portland where, you know, major galleries or even upstart galleries will tend to focus on younger artists from larger metropolitan areas like Los Angeles or New York and feel that they need to bring those artists into the city to endow all Portlanders with a sense of higher intellect and beauty. Whereas there's a lot of amazing artists working in Portland who are under-recognized and under-supported and underfunded. So I think that fact alone and my interest in bringing their art to walls and spaces for the public to see it, and in hopes in the future possibly exporting that work outside of Portland, that's probably the main reason why I do what I do.
And that whole conversation about Portland being somewhat provincial, we're known as a liberal bastion, and yet in some ways the funding and the money and those elements are sort of the conservative reality of a liberal facade that we have in Portland. Now, Portland's a wonderful place, but we've seen, probably every one of us has seen, that
very talented Portland artists end up leaving this market to make a living as an artist. And that's been an ongoing sort of struggle for Portland, trying to recognize what it has, the potential that it has as a creative city versus that potential to actually support and sustain working artists. And I think what Ruth Ann is saying, you know, and doing, in fact, is living that, solving that very problem. And why she remains in the game is because it is rewarding. It is, you know, something important.
So why do you stay in the game?
Well, Ryan? I mean, theoretically, in some respects, the existential question is never stared directly in the face. We like to think about at some point someone tricked me. I don't know where I read about the arts being, you know, just a blast all the time. You know, it's like you get to jet set around the world. You get to meet very important people. You you know, everyone loves art, right? So you're bringing a sense of betterment to the world, and it's just one wild ride. No rules, right? That's the way the art world works.
You got into it to be a rock star.
No, but I you know, I like hanging around with the rock stars.
You got in it to be part of the crew.
I'm just a hanger on. I think that there is a romantic notion of what it means to be in the arts, and for different people, it's different things. But there is this sort of camaraderie that you have in the arts world that I've really enjoyed over the years. I've met some fantastic people. I think that keeps me going in some respects, is that the most interesting ideas, while science, you know, there are a lot of very crazy things going on that are hyper, you know, intense and interesting. The arts world always brings some wacky idea to my, you know, puts it in front of me, and it's just endlessly fascinating, the people that you meet. I think that's one element of it, that human interaction part. The other thing is, what else do you do in the world? How do you bring yourself to interact with the rest of the world in a way that's positive for people? Opening an arts organization, hey, that's one way. You know, let's not dismiss that. It's fascinating. You do reach out to people. You have a lot of people that interact with you that benefit from the services that you provide, and the ideas that you're able to put forth through your efforts. There's very little reward for it, though. There's very, very little reward monetarily. The traditional I make a living doing this is not accurate. Especially in Portland, where the cultural infrastructure just isn't big enough. I mean, people move to Portland thinking they're going to get a job in the arts, and, you know, that means Kinko's. I don't know what it means. It means something different. It means something different in Portland.
What's wrong with FedEx Kinko's Incorporated?
FedEx Kinko's, not at all. I mean, there's a lot of creative time to be spent there, but. You know, I do feel that Portland's infrastructure doesn't really support getting a serious art job, or one that pays enough to do it without having some other type of extraneous income from a separate job.
Yeah, actually, I've been asking myself, which I'd be interested to hear your response. Many people and myself, the question: how many artists in Portland exist who can afford to make a living just by making their own work, and who aren't independently wealthy or who have a spouse who supports them?
And that's a fair question. I mean, that's a reality around the world. There are a lot of artists that do have other means of support outside of their art, and it allows them to focus on art. And in some cases, it allows them to become, you know, really good at what they do, so that they do become
right,
you know, artists in their own right.
The number I came up with was less than five, though.
how official is that?
It's official in both my brain racking, as well as I asked David Rowe that question. He actually came up with four. David Rowe, for the listeners out there, is probably the head art critic in Portland. He's the art critic for the Oregonian and has been so for quite a while. So his expertise I would trust.
he's definitely seen a lot of artists come and go, I'm sure.
So, quickly,
okay,
to switch gears, but to keep in the similar vein, speaking of these artists in Portland, who are some of the local favorites? Who are some of the people who have got you all spiced up and hot under the covers? Who is it?
Well, for our programming in 2008 and 2009, which was stipend-based, I selected 10 artists who I would think that my giving them each $8,000 for a six-week exhibit shows that I'm in love with them. Those artists are The Video Gentleman, TJ Norris, Jacqueline Ailis, Laura Fritz, Stephen Slappy, Vanessa Rennick, and Ty Innes, to say a few. I think all these artists are work in a variety of media, are approaching new media and video installation in a specifically interesting way, and ultimately who are more concerned with the work they're making than cultivating an artist persona, which oftentimes I think is the primary focus for artists who are coming out of school with MFAs and perhaps what I like to classify as artists who make cleverly heartless work.
Ooh, cutting to say the least. Now, one of the things, though, that in current MFA programs they teach is that marketing tool of creating your own Andy Warhol, if you will, to better sell yourself. And you guys would disagree with that as a marketing strategy?
I think it's an effective marketing strategy. I don't see how it's going to get you through a career or through the day oftentimes as far as keeping you motivated to make work, keeping your interests in art in general agile. I mean, if you spend all of your time cultivating a persona, where do you really exist in reality?
There are, I guess, many ways to approach what being a true artist actually entails. And I know that in the graduate programs, perhaps they are teaching artists that they need to shine their own star, polish it up, throw it out there. It's make-believe in some respects, because where does the artistic value come from? What are they striving towards? Is it just a facade? I don't know. I mean, some people say that about Andy Warhol. I mean, some people really truly believe that the, you know, his artistic genius was overblown.
What about you?
Not at all. I mean, it's fascinating, and as the precursor to what we are now seeing as that model of, you know, being Andy Warhol. I mean, marketing wise, commodity wise, and with the actual art, he was kind of the whole package. But I think people are skipping some of those components, and this kind of turns into a conversation about what's happening with art schools around the country, even but specifically here in Portland. We have I would say three major players: Portland State University, which has a graduate program; Oregon College of Art and Craft, which also has a graduate program; and the Pacific Northwest College of Art, which has recently established a graduate program. With all three of those entities having been around for decades, they're sort of now each coming into their own in a way, with PNCA leading the way and establishing itself as the major arts college in the region. But the question is, are they backing up their growth, physical growth, their buying of new buildings, their taking over of existing institutions? Are they backing that up with a curriculum that is producing quality artists?
Before we dive into that, let me ask you the question. Did either of you get MFAs or Masters in Arts?
No, I did not.
No.
So, I mean, did you get BFAs, BAs, anything?
Yes, art history for me.
No.
Okay, so perhaps you're, just for the listener's point, your view perhaps might be skewed.
Skewed towards what? Towards being skeptical?
Skewed towards, you know.
That's my natural view on everything. I don't feel like I'm being any more skeptical. No, it could be that I want to see, I'm now engaged in the arts. It's my occupation, and Whether or not I studied or was indoctrinated, shall we say, in the arts world, in the cloth of an MFA program, I've studied it. I am sociologically watching what happens with art students. I've known them now for 8 years. I've watched them in school. I've watched them now out of school. So there's sort of I don't know if you want to call it a generational, one generation of art students has come and gone since my time at Portland. And so I'm curious, I'm concerned. I do want to see a serious arts entity here in Portland that can become more of a national presence, that can draw artists, that can gain a reputation. That's one of the core infrastructure things that this city needs. If it's going to establish itself as a national center for contemporary art, it also needs the underbelly of the infrastructure, which is the contemporary arts organizations, which have also had a tough time finding footing, and that's a personal experience that I have. So I don't know if I'm skewed. I want to ask hard questions, and I don't know that I need any kind of degree to do that. But fair enough.
And I wouldn't say that either Brian or I are inherently against bettering yourself in your education or MFA programs overall, but you have to admit that there's a freakish number of MFA programs creeping up around the country.
A tidal wave of MFAs, actually.
It's frightening. Oh. And, I mean, how many young people are convinced that by going into debt another $40,000 to $70,000 to $80,000 is going to help them get a degree, or obviously they're getting a degree, but help them get a degree further in their career in general. I can't emphasize to you at my operation, which is me, myself, and I, for the most part, with one girl who comes in one day a week, how many emails I get from recent MFA graduates wanting a job. And you need just to walk through my door to realize that I'm not employing anyone, really. And that scares me. So.
Tell me the best one that you've got.
The best what?
The best email. The best solicitation.
I can't do that.
Yes, you can. Come on now.
Like what school they came from?
No, or? Tell me what their pitch was. What's the best pitch you guys have heard recently? Job.
The pitches are never interesting at all. No, no. The pitches, if the pitches were interesting, I would respond to them. I'm sorry, all of you out there who have never gotten an email back from me. But when you send an email that's really obviously generic, like dear sir or ma'am, and you know nothing about what we do here at NAAU, the programming.
All right, art's all the same. It's all the same thing. I mean,
you got paintings, right?
Yeah, you hang them on a wall. What the hell do you need to know? I have an MFA. going into that conversation, how many people do you get actually soliciting you for exhibition opportunities? Not just job opportunities.
Right. Well, I prefer to accept submissions in February. So I try to make that as obvious as possible. Without that, I probably still get about 20 to 30 a month. And also, I have to say, the majority of those submissions, people do have MFAs. And going through them, it's pretty scary how many people have MFAs who have never even had a solo exhibit before. And that just begs the question I ask all the time, which is, how can you understand any theory before practice? Which is one thing that MFA programs seem to just churn out. And I mean, you need to be a practicing artist, you need to have a studio practice, you need to be a human being who is experiencing things in the world, I think, before you should even consider going and getting an MFA.
And that goes back to that conversation of what is it, what kind of training is being provided? What realistic training, what professional development opportunities are happening at the MFA level? One of the things that Disjecta is attempting, and this sort of came up as an opportunity recently, is that the three major arts schools here in Portland will all have exhibits. Their students will all exhibit work at Disjecta. And that is a definite focus of ours, to assist with those professional development opportunities that these artists need to really get out and work in the real world. They won't be solo exhibitions, but they will be off campus in a professional environment, and hopefully give these artists, or artists to be, artists in training, a sense of what it means to exhibit your work in a contemporary gallery space. So we're excited to work with the schools and try and help them develop their curriculums. That's one thing that I hope that we can continue to do. And we will set aside time to help students learn those things.
Sounds good. I had a question for both of you, and this goes back to kind of, you know, yourselves both being students at one time. What was that kind of moment that I would say that click in your brain where you got kicked in the teeth by some sort of art exhibit that you saw someplace? What fired the imagination for both of you? What would you say?
Well, you know, I mean, as a person who studied art history, that's a really difficult question to answer because I've looked at so much art prior and since. I think that the thing that first got me interested in this, which Brian sort of touched on with when he mentioned that this lifestyle is kind of romanticized as a member of the art community, is that I really first entered it properly, I think, socially. My friends were artists. I surrounded myself with creative people, and I genuinely felt like my life was better for being around them and for understanding kind of non-linear thought, which I think art and the art community is great for generating. I would say that, you know, probably the best exhibits I've seen have been since my degree, partially because more of an adult now, and I can look at things in more of a educated fashion, and not from an MFA, but from experience. And I don't know. And I think that I fall in love with every exhibit I've had at the gallery, and I think that I'm fortunate just to be able to live with this work for 6 weeks.
I don't think that necessarily visual art was the thing that drew me into the arts. It was sort of a panoply of different things. Film, German cinema, of all things, German
Girl.
Cinema. Wim Wenders and Fassbinder and Aguirre, Wrath of God. I mean, these crazy, just crazy movies that I hadn't experienced before. And then... you know, back in high school, I sort of delved into the artistic community a little bit and started to read Henry Miller and get into the literary aspect of the arts. So those things certainly drew me in to that vigilant artistic world. From there, I think, you know, I, not being trained in art, maybe took a more mundane route. You know, I was in Spain. I went to the Reina Sofia, and I saw Guernica, which has always been one of my favorite pieces just because of the story behind the actual work. But to see that massive piece of work on display is definitely a formative moment for me in my, I guess I was, what, 20, something like that. And my appreciation for the visual arts, for installation art, for conceptual art has really grown since then. And there are, I mean, numerous, once they pop into my head, I'll name them.
one guy.
I mean, it's a goddamn medley up there. I'm stirring it around right now. I just can't pull anything out.
So let me ask you this, though. I mean, one of the things that I really gauge art by, and you know, isn't a textbook kind of analysis, isn't a checklist or something like that, but it's a kind of a feeling of my skin being on fire when I see something or experience something that you know, the back of my you know, spine kind of tingles a little bit, and the hair on my arm stands up, and I kind of get a little short of breath, and that's how I know I'm experiencing good art? When was the last time you had
that? That's incredibly detailed, but what was the, what when was the last time that happened to you?
I was in Cecily Brown's studio 2 weeks ago.
Where?
In Manhattan.
I see. I had a very, actually a very recent experience like that, with an artist that I've always appreciated her work. Anna Fiddler is a Portland-based artist who's also worked in LA and I think shows in New York. I visited her studio and she has a new body of work, that she's putting together, based on all things, basketball. And when I saw the piece that was completed, the energy of the piece, the unique quality of the work on paper, painting, it all combined to give me a sense of this is something pretty special. And, you know, you come across those things and that's a small one, for example, but that immediately, you know, I took out my pen and I said, we're going to make this show happen right now. Because this is too damn good, and this is something special that you don't see every day, and the subject matter is different, and her talent level is immense, and all those things combining in one place. That's the most recent example for me. When you said studio visit, that bam, that came right to the front of my mind.
Yeah, I'd say that I don't have the same sensation, but what you're speaking of tends to mostly only happen with me with the type of art and art exhibits that I know that I'm fortunate to be able to see exhibits that are temporal, that are not going to be reproduced necessarily anywhere else, that should I not be at that moment in time or in a bandwidth of time, I will never see for the rest of my life. Only people who are participating at that time will be able to see. The last time that happened was when I went down to San Diego to see Who's Afraid of Red, Yellow, Blue, the Robert Irwin installation at the Museum of Contemporary Art, San Diego.
Was it good? I didn't get to see it.
It was amazing.
Tell me a little bit.
Well, I mean, anyone who is able to experience bodily Robert Irwin's exhibits probably knows the answer to that, but Robert Irwin has always interested me for his specific ability to sort of harness that temporality in a monumental way, and really approach art from a non-commodity aspect. I mean, obviously, you know, the man's making money. He's making money in a variety of different ways, but his objects themselves exist almost always for only a specific moment in time, and he's really committed to that idea. And I think that I'm also interested in that idea right now because there is just too much fucking art being made. I mean, we have bazillions of these objects floating around that we don't know where they're going to end up. We're trying to assign some sort of value to them, and we really have no idea where they fit, and intellectually or culturally, in this place and time.
Well, now you bring up a good point, but there are many sides to this question. One, you know, being that, you know, there's kind of the idea that there's a gate on art, that like there's a certain amount of art that is good for a populace, you know what I mean? And others would argue that, you know, the more art that you actually push in, the greater the level becomes for, you know, art.
Have you ever heard of super saturation?
Do you think that we're at super saturation right now?
Not a lot really good comes from that. I mean, that term. So if we are at that level, if we are at a point where the floodgates have opened and we're neck deep in useless meanderings of people's minds, then that is bad. But I can't judge that. I'm not interested in necessarily judging that. People are free to pursue their paths, their intellectual creative paths, all over the world, my friend, America. But there does exist entities in a small way, like New American Art Union, like Disjecta. That we do try and elevate certain work, certain artists, certain people that are providing I guess, a greater sense of being, a greater sense of what it is to be alive, a greater sense of intellectual capacity, if you will. And that's, I think, that's that onus becomes ours, not the artists. Artists should proliferate. Should they proliferate? They should proliferate, and they should make art. And you know, people of all stripes interact with art differently. And there does have to be a higher ground. I think there is. Obviously, we all know that there's great work out there, and there is good work, and there's mediocre work, and there's work that just should crawl away and die. But they all exist in the world. In really any avocation, vocation, doesn't matter. These things occur, and our job is to sort through it.
I think that the biggest problem, honestly, ideologically, sure, make whatever you want. That's fine. Everyone deserves to love what they do and put it out there. But the biggest problem is that it dilutes everything. You know, I would say that the average medium-sized collector in Portland, for example, probably spends over the course of their lifetime somewhere between $50,000 and $75,000 on artwork. Right?
A year or total?
In their lifetime. Oh. In their lifetime. Okay. And so what does that mean? That means that you go into their house and every fucking square inch is covered with something. If that makes them happy, sure, that's fine. But what if you took
$1,000 and rented a storage unit and curated your house?
No, what if they took $50,000 or $75,000, let's just say 50, whatever that number is, and adopted a model similar to like United States artists, which gives out $50,000 grants to individual artists every year, and gave one artist $50,000 a year, or I mean $50,000 total, to go to art school or to further their career? And what would that do for the art community at large? How much of a better place would that put us in? I think we'd be in a lot better place than spending $300 here, $200 there.
Are you talking about eugenics? Are you talking about selective breeding of artists? What are you saying?
Do I need to take an IQ test after this? What's going on? Like,
that in a utopian world, maybe, you know, I do think United States artists is doing amazing things. And you know, we're left with the discerning. Who are the discerning minds? And United States artists clearly has people
right.
that can discern. Where your average collector is collecting work that means something to them personally, and that could be all over the world and all over the map. I'm sorry, and you know, I like the oddities that the collectors
sure,
come up with.
Sure. I'm just saying that the volume of things floating around in the art world today, object-wise, idea-wise, all of this, is so difficult for most people to weed through to find what is inherently valuable.
Doesn't that allow the more stellar work to rise up? I mean, to be very visible, to rise above, to be...
Well, I mean, sure, that's, you know, the evolutionary model that we all live by. How effective that is, I still don't know. And I should let you know that I'm quasi-biased here, because I firmly believe that not all ideas deserve to exist in form, which is sort of the foundation of art in general. Sometimes when people are hyper-narrative and they want to tell me about, you know, their upsetting breakup or whatever, I don't know why that's of value to me necessarily. But anyway.
I would agree with that. I mean, obviously not every idea should find a form in the world. That's why we're supposed to have the ability to decipher and discern what things have value and meaning. But that's a societal, that's an overall societal value that...
But you both, as, you know, kind of gatekeepers of culture, decide that as
well,
no? And
correct. And so we're among a small group of people who have an opportunity to weed that out. This is what what we were saying earlier. We're in a unique position now we're only going to be supported in some cases. And this is especially true of a commercial space, which I think both Ruth Ann and I have sort of navigated away from in a lot of ways. But in the commercial gallery space, you're going to stay in business as long as you're supported by collectors and people who want to buy the work that's being shown in your space. And there's a truism in that it's got to be good, but it's also got to be good to the people that are buying it. And those can be two different things. And in respect to where we're at with our with the gallery and institution is that, or organization is that, we have the ability to take more risk and look to the higher motive in the work and be more discerning and help to elevate the things that we think are important. And that's, you know, that's the capitalist way. That's the democratic way. I mean, we've been raised that way. We can't really think any other way.
So
it's hard to.
That's a bittersweet and yet, you know, I would say pragmatic approach. Now, tell me on the flip side of that, what do you consider to be your greatest? I mean, your ultimate, not penultimate, but all the way, the zenith fuck up that you've made as a arts director.
Yeah, why don't you let me tackle that one first, Brian? thanks. Jesus. Fuck up. I've made so many mistakes that that's kind of a difficult question to answer. And I think that it's mistakes are inherently extremely valuable. I can think of mistakes from building out this space in general when we got the building and when I bought it. It was just a standard CMU warehouse. It was built in 1960 as a radiator workshop.
CMU is concrete masonry unit. For those of you who are not architects or builders out there.
Thank you, Brian.
Yes.
And, you know, things down to, like, I really wish it had different types of lighting, which is a very expensive thing to change out. That was a mistake. To, in the beginning, I perhaps forged too personal of friendships with some of the artists who were involved in the space, which it is a mistake, I think. Although I continue to be very good friends with several artists who show here on a consistent basis, there needs to be some sort of professional separation at the beginning. I am generally a completely transparent person, at least I aspire to be. That transparency has gotten me in trouble in the past. I think it is good to edit yourself a little bit. So that's just some of the many mistakes I've absolutely made.
Well done.
yeah, I mean, there are a bevy of things that have been mistakes in terms of getting off the ground and started in the arts world. I think Ruth Ann is saying that, and perhaps she was maybe a little naive, too trusting in some cases.
Sure,
and I think you always start out that way because you don't know what the art world is really made of, which is, you know, dragon tongues and witches' toenails and things like that. It's pretty nasty out there in the real world. People are vying for attention. People are vying for money. It's no different than any other business world in that respect. And I think that when I stepped into opening a large nonprofit organization, I didn't necessarily understand all the nuances of people with money, people who want to see things a certain way, and people with an agenda. And I definitely got burned by that in some respects. I've also...
How?
I trust people too far. I ran with them a little bit, and maybe, you know, I should have looked at the situation more realistically and said, what do they want out of this? Wait a minute. Or is there an agenda outside of just this grand idea to open an arts organization for the city of Portland? I can't really get into specifics. I mean, that's... I've forgotten all of them.
I just have this
lingering, burning feeling somewhere. I mean, that's a very general thing, and I mean it to be general. I mean it to be general. It wasn't anything that was terrible. It just, it's just one of those things, you know, you got to keep your head on a swivel and have both sides covered.
So, that being said, what would you give as advice to people coming into this world, this world, as you said, full of witches' toenails?
Right. I mean, one of the major things, and the other mistake I made, is don't overpromise. Don't promise more than you can provide. And that's the romantic side of things. I do have a romantic side. I know you called me a pragmatist earlier, but that's a little inaccurate. I do like...
You'll be taking me out to dinner afterwards.
I do like to mix my romanticism with my pragmatism. I find that's a pretty interesting little concoction. But that said, you don't want to overpromise. You have this great romantic idea that you're going to be able to provide all of these things, and then you get into the actual scenario itself and you realize, oh my God, well, I don't have the money to do that, or I don't have the time. It's going to take 14 weeks to make that happen, and I can't make that happen. And people don't necessarily understand. They understand that you told them something, but they don't understand the reality of it any more than you did at the time when you said it. But it's hard to take it back, and it's hard to reclaim those feelings from people. So that can be a trap to avoid. Is don't oversell it. Don't promise more than you can provide. Under promise, and if you provide more, you're a national hero. You know, ticker tape. Yeah, it's amazing. What are some of the other? I know, Ruth Ann, what would you?
Well, I think my advice in general, which is an extremely difficult thing to accomplish in this day and age, is it's really important for me, and I think anyone involved in not just the arts community but life in general, to give themselves time. I mean, especially in this country, people just don't give themselves time to think through anything. And I think a lot of mistakes are made when you don't just touch back on the base of, you know, for me, I ask myself as often as possible, why am I doing this and what is its purpose? And, you know, I take a month off every year, which I know most people can't even begin to accomplish, but I also think a lot of people could accomplish that with different value system. And, you know, if you don't check in on what you're doing, then you just end up on this treadmill moving towards something. You're not exactly sure why, you're not sure what it is, and you're not sure what the outcome would possibly be.
This is not my beautiful house.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, thank you both so very much. My name is Zephyr Thrall. You're listening to Frank Prattle on Art International Radio at artonair.org. We're here in Portland, Oregon, inside the very belly of the beast, the New American Art Union, which is run by one of our guests, the lovely and talented Ruth Ann Brown, as well as the lovely and talented Brian Sereth, coming from Disjected to talk to us. Thank you both so much.
Thank you, Zephyr.
Been a pleasure.